This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We were into the whole issue of the physical content of writing, in the sense of the physical content of the occasion of writing, e.g. whether you use a typewriter or a pencil. These are not questions to be checked right or wrong, or yes or no, even, but simply you're trying to bring the point of focus to some sense of what the occasion of writing was in this way. What happened, for example, if you used a notebook or a pen or pencil, or if you were confined, as I am, to using a typewriter. What happened if you suddenly found yourself using legal-size papers as opposed to 8x11? What happened if there were noises? All this sense, whether the room was large or small. What feelings, in other words, were accumulating in terms of this kind of physical reference. We also got involved with the sense of what do we hear for, in the sense of can we teach? Have we taken money in that sense under false pretenses? And what your expectations were. We never did hear what your expectations were, but I mean that's your privacy, which is being respected. More than the occasion, frankly, allows ours to be. But I want to stop all that. I want to reduce the sense of it all to the fact of what is. In other words, what is present. The agony of, say, last evening's conversation, as we were talking, ultimate tongue, he is here. Three days and nights on the train without sleep, so that I thought it was, there's no reason to make him be here, because it says everyone should be here. He'll be here this evening, he'll be here Monday, more relaxed form. Anyhow, Robert, what would you want to do? Can you think of anything relevant to that whole sense of physical act?
On the physical thing, yeah. While you were talking, I was, if you get right to where you start on a poem, one thing that was coming through my mind as you were talking was, that even the area that you allow yourself for writing on the page is worth looking at. You can sometimes suddenly realize that you are doing something over and over and over again. If you have the feeling you're in a rut, and you can realize what it is by looking at the shape of how much of the area of the page you're covering, and merely decide, no, I'm going to force myself to do it entirely differently, and then see if that, because one of the things you have, all, at least as far as I know so far, you have all your writing life long, is this thing called the rut you get into, and that's not the kind you get in the spring, but the kind that you get into in an automobile. And as we did, we tried to drive out for a nice little picnic at Gold Beach. Like it really was a beach buggy track, and we really were in a overloaded convertible, but we weren't going to admit it until everything stopped. Well, especially, those of you who are acquainted with my poetry know that I drive an overloaded convertible. As a matter of fact, I keep trying to put new luggage in it all the time, and the luggage compartment is not really, it doesn't accommodate everything I want to put in the car. Then, so you do get bogged down. But back to what I started with. So one of the things you can do is to say, oh, for God's sake, I was a beach buggy track that went here, and here I am in an entirely different kind of car. How did I get here? And from there on, you've got to start improvising. We went out and got planks and had to find our way out of this Gold Beach. You could even go the other way around, as we all know, and go into it, in which case you become a character of poetry. They've had them over and over again. The poetry counterpart of cutting your ear off, except Van Gogh didn't paint it along that line, but there is a way of going in deeper and deeper in the sand, and then everybody who's interested in lost automobiles, you're their guy. But if you're really not so intrigued with getting into the deep sand, but want this business of making a poem and want to keep it free, that is, if you're interested in freedom, actually a poet can go into the opposite of freedom, which is always his self. And then he doesn't need to worry about the shape of anything on the page. He just simply gets to realize just more and more. And at the ultimate, could get to the place where he can hardly bear to have anything on that page because it interferes with his deep sand stuff. But the opposite of it, really being able to manipulate, certainly changing even just the sheer shape of the poem. But I find back to the business about writing, I always write with pencil or pen. Sometimes I've written with pencil because I want to, because if I felt I wrote it with a pen, then it would have to be important. And I might have to worry about whether it was a good poem or not, which I realized I wouldn't be able to write at all if I was worrying about that. So then I write with pencil. But I write with pen usually because I can hear. I used to think it was because I can hear. And now I find that when I type poems, I sometimes make revisions, and actually I don't know why I think I can't hear through the clatter of a typewriter. Actually, the reason I wrote was because I earned my living typing manuscripts, and that makes I didn't really want to mix that up with sitting down at a typewriter is the worst part of the game, because every time it's as if I were you're actually thinking, well, now $2, $3 an hour I'm paying myself to do this ugly part of the job. But then certainly back to when Charles observed how much you can compose for yourself at the typewriter. That's the other thing. I think the people who merely write and don't go to the typewriter are fine if you're going to read your poems aloud, but the real thing that happens today is that the poem goes to the printed book, and you have quite a control. You discover a notation, a relation really between the poem you have in your mind and the way the world's ever going to see it, including yourself when it's an object. Visual, and that notation is certainly developed in relation to the printed page and the typewriter page. And there's in the poems there, it's perfectly evident that quite a number of you use that already as far as the game goes at the present time. So that's the other thing. We're going to have to be talking about something ahead of the, because there's a wide common area now that actually has become as much a conventional form. Say the way the line is used in William Carlos Williams has become as conventional as a tired old sonnet. I mean, you can't tell a damn thing when you see very expert shifting of lines, because we can all do it. They learned to waltz in 1812 or something, you know, and now it's 1830 and even grandma's waltzing and she doesn't dance. That's what's happened in poems, you know. I mean, God, people are writing poems that are better... Better per square inch. I keep saying, gee, you know, like if I could write that good, like, except that there's no poem around.
I was looking at some of the poems that are printed up from the class, and there are some of them in short lines with some of the words broken in half, like Williams or like
everybody.
Poetry, like everybody's doing that now. And the point was that there was no particular reason for it to be that way. It would have been easier to read it for a longer line, and it didn't make any sense one way or the other. So it was just imitation.
I wanted to jump the thing Robert, we were talking in the sense of using the typewriter as a possibility or as an occasion that allowed the possibility of understanding what the form of the book would be, or what it would look
like.
Yeah,
and how to notate movement.
I'm at the moment caught in the whole intersection of what is responsible conduct in respect to, you know, audience. In other words, I remember in an interview apropos of poetry with David Austin, someone asked for. Cuts this part out. He questioned the whole context of what he called beatnik writing, and I was saying, well, look, I don't consider Alan responsible for the uses of his writing in this sense. And as I don't hold Alan responsible for what, say, Time Magazine does to the context of his work. I mean, it's a bit of fact. I just don't. And I'm thinking now, how far do we go with this sense? In other words, we want the, as you, in your instances of writing, clearly want the poem to represent something in the sense of the formal context of appearance that allows reading to be accurate. How far can we go with this? You know, in the sense of how far do we go into our public before we not only exist but endanger it?
I don't ever think of this part I was talking about as being something about the public, because what you can assume is that anything you begin to see as notation for the movement of a poem, some and the other person who's ever going to read you can certainly understand as much about it as you do.
Yeah.
So that as a matter of fact, the person who's going to read you is always going to be somewhat disappointed in what you do, wanting more of you than you could possibly get in that. I mean, if you think of who that other person is that possibly reads over there, as a matter of fact, legitimately, that other person over there is, as Gertrude Stein said, a stranger. And that, even if it's your closest friend, insofar as it's a reader, it's a stranger, because this person has really keyed in to what you are that you yourself are trying to key in writing. In writing, you're keying into something about yourself that you know, that you do not know in any other way, that you discover in the thing that you write. Now, this is any level almost of your writing. I mean, just take writing a letter. Write yourself a letter or someone else a letter. All of a sudden, some new appears or refuses to appear, and then you can't write a letter. And this one is in, for the writer and for the reader. Then is really it really is this department called stranger. Every poet, the poets who feel they know who they are or have something to say, and then try to struggle with words and say this thing you think you have to say. You really are trying to find somebody you in a sense don't know in any other way when you start writing the very first line and being with it. And that's hidden
in all of it, because the person who comes out in the writing, or the identity that comes out in the writing, is a familiar identity also. I mean, like old recognizable identity that you saw before.
Well, Eric Reiner's has a nice one when you use familiar, because he has one that combines that stranger and the familiar. He says, you are most estranged from that with which you are most familiar. You are the furthest from the center. I mean, from the center that you are is the. Anyway, to me, I think this is one of the differences that makes a very. After all, we're talking about the fact that poetry has different ways of conceiving its form. I would conceive the form of a poem very much with this business of a counterpoint of some kind. Go right back to just a vowel structure, and forget all this thing that we get in, because it's going to be the same picture. You take the schwa, the when you're caught and you can't think of what I've got to say, it comes. That's because we're American, but it's also a whole Indo-European, and in theory, all these other vowels come into being as consonants come into being. Now think of a counterpoint and just the sound thing. By the time you get a whole group of other vowels coming from here and coming because certain consonants come into existence and shape them around, I'm trying to give you an idea of the double system that's happening here and something we take for granted. in communication level, as far as the evolution theory goes, at the level of the ape, you have semantics. The meaning. What does it mean is our first ape-like question. The only thing the human being, that happened in the human being in evolution was that the vocal apparatus developed the ability to shape vowels. That's the thing the ape can't do. And so there's a funny area of information that is purely human, and that's the sound, and subhuman, and that's the meaning that everybody, we think is so, you know, like, what does it mean? And Maya Kala says, well, not this. And this is why we're bored, I think, really, with the meanings of words. I mean, we're always engaged in it. Of course, like, the ape is there. You know, I go ape. That means really every pedant you ever saw in your life was real ape. And then when something lovely sort of that we call lovely because we're human starts happening along with the ape, by the way, you know, we grow this way, so this is our. As I put it upside down, the schwa should go along here, and these things come floating out of here as things from a tree, and we've always got this meaning thing. We keep pushing. Could it ever become lovely? Meanings are so unlovely, you know. But you don't get what I mean, man. And every time you're pushing this thing here, and what a poem does, the one thing it really does is to be able all of a sudden, and I can't, I wonder how you could ever get across what happens when this becomes the most important thing, like it was some super meaning, like something above, I mean in the sense of the upness of a tree. Now you know you've got roots down here that have more than to do, like feelings are way down here, and feelings ought to be traced right back to the fact that you are your first, you know, your real roots, and if you want to go back to roots, your real roots are right back at the very first life form that is also quite contemporaneous with you. In this sense, in Peter McClure's called Revolt, he really describes this thing and relates himself to the planaria. You know, this is big integration, not the little kind that people keep. The ones inhabiting this area are always wondering, you know, up, down, over, under, black, white, green, pink. But so it goes in both directions. But now, what happens in a work of art, for me, Well, look for this. Oh, I know what I'm talking about now. Okay. Where in the hell is this so familiar to you? By the time you got the roots down here, yeah, that's so familiar to you is the planaria, and by the time you got up here, the so familiar to you is just a bunch of gas. I mean, you know, air coming out of your mouth. And like for the satirist, it's always wind. You know, I mean, there are two kinds. Well, there are two ways of playing with language, imitating both ends that are possible in the realm of spirit. And Rabelais is one is spirited and Shelley spirited. It's really air coming out, and then music, and that's what I was. So that you're a stranger, all that business of I that we think oughtn't to be there, but it is. Gosh, what kind of a, you know, that's real. You can't get what you are, but you're also this. Like, have some, you know, flowers, leaves. What happens? Sometimes, of course, they turn around and they look at somebody who's got I, and they say, well, I don't want a trunk. For God's sake, I mean, I'll be a tree without those awful old roots and the dirt, and I'll be a tree without all that shaggy, because I'm really just leaves and flowers, me. And then you get these goddamn poems that try to produce leaves and flowers without so much as a twig for the much less sap. I don't want to be a sap, they say. No, I don't want to ever be a sap. So they close it off because that juice, God knows where it comes from. But this, actually, this apparatus is, you're either tuning, this is the criterion that's not, this is a criterion that is part of what you're asking to tune into when you even want to write a poem. Oh, I know, lots of you, I'm sure, think that you want to tune in on the little magazine that you're already looking like. But you know, you can't even, I mean, that's the eight part here, but you can't tune in on the little magazine without running risks. Because some goofball in the little magazine is going to have some root thing here or something like that, and you'll get involved sooner or later, or else you lose interest. That also happens. My God, look at this room full. How many out of this whole room full could survive even remotely interested in the poem by the time they're 40? I mean, I guess most of you, I mean, they like to read it, I mean, that's fine, on Tuesday, but if you never discover this other thing, something that's of life value for you in a poem, and I think this is the difficult thing in our whole age, and as Bob keeps wanting to resist that this is a classroom, our whole age in which the poem is a very important part of culture, so that you are making culture gains and improving its status by knowing about poetry and having sensibility and getting to be, that's a very different picture. And because it's, as a matter of fact, that whole picture is one, the one of being educated, is a way of not ever tapping on this tree. Not ever recognizing, you know, who your nearest educated planaria. I go find out. And that's where you begin, and that's the route you have to always drive back into, not the first grade, which, was a different picture.
I thought, for example, yesterday this headline saying of peace agreement and abandonment. And here's a beautiful instance of the problems of meaning. Do I feel? I mean, is this an occasion for my feeling?
Yeah, well, you don't. I think there's a reason you don't. As a matter of fact, you can't have rooted all that area of there's a whole area of the poem of ourselves and so forth that we could almost enclose here, and it has to do with meaning. When Khrushchev I can't think of what was the name of our president, Kennedy isn't this year, when they start singing, you know, having a little concerts or something, we might get it up into this area, but most of it's very much in this meaning area, and they most of all don't, you know, they're ready, planaria, they'll do away with it with DDT or anything any day. That's, I mean, to purify the water would be a great help. And trees, all of you should read a book on, let's see, it's something tree.
Joyce Kilmer.
No, not Joyce Kilmer, the trees, like trees. Oh, I do have, I have a marvelous aged aunt who is a stalwart and imaginative theosophist, and I lent her The Wasteland with great glee when I was because I began to realize, gee, that's packed, and I want to see how she would think it. She said, well, you know, he's got everything in there, I know it's about, but she said she should write a real poem like Trees, and then she recited Trees all the way through. After half an hour, by the way, giving me all the lowdown on The Wasteland, which is for the same sources that he had all that lowdown, and she said, yeah, but that isn't what poetry is. So maybe that's why I always got a tree in my mind. A tree or a door, they say.
I think equally right, in terms of your own work, simply this sad middle, you know, through which sad middle ancient through all which echoes with love for Lincoln. This seems to me now an equivalent.
Oh, and also what's the poet's imagination in history?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, something else happens then. We aren't just breath.
No.
Yeah, we could talk about the thing we call love, which also seems to absolutely subsume this whole area of reason. And we recognize it. Oh, the hard thing to recognize is how all these vowels, this noise I'm making by vibrating and releasing air into the air, a breath into the air, how in the world it really relates to these roots and this sap. I'm talking about something that vaguely could be, people today talk about unconscious all the time, and now I've noticed in some criticism I don't want to avoid it. Brother Antoninus has come out with a criterion in which certain people have unconsciouses that are considerably better than other people's unconsciouses. Bigger, deeper, more resounding, Well, since all the content I've got in poems is craftily, consciously loaded with what we call the unconscious, I mean, I ransacked every little... So anything that resembles an unconscious reverberation in my poems has been loaded in to give it actually some, what I feel is depth or resonance or orchestration. What I feel is something like an unconscious, and that's part of what McClure's after in this revolt thing, are these roots. And then beyond that, the fact that these roots that we call life are one with the cosmos, so that when we get down to the final end of rooting, the roots aren't the end. You're coming from more than roots, because you're in. You are a fact of the universe, and your poem is an event at that level. This is the thing that actually... Olson, in 57, was filled with and clear about, and maybe he won't bother, I don't know, because he's always with the idea he's with. So I think it's not robbing the nest to give some picture of this. It's Whitehead's picture in which you also realize that your poem is a cosmic event. This becomes absurd, then. The critic comes along, who's nervous about what's going to happen. Is the tree going to get out of order? Is it going to crowd out the other trees? Do we really want a maple in that corner of the lawn? I know it came up, and it looked like it isn't going to go down, but if we got a little hatchet, and then we could burn out the roots, maybe. But the trouble about poems is that it's awful hard to hatchet it down and burn out the roots, because actually it's an event. And so while we could chop a tree down, an event takes place just where it does. The poem happened when it was written, but on the page it happens every time it's read. And this is the other thing that always fascinates me. Every poem I realize that has ever come into my life has come into my life from some event. How is it that it happened to T.S. Eliot? He puts it on a page, and then it happens somehow to me. And then other times it doesn't happen to me at all. I mean, the very same poem. I now have been living with poetry intensely long enough to know the poems that were very important to me, seemed the very center, can become utterly unimportant. Poems that I know are great poems, like Milton, who I read in my early 20s, I haven't read him for years, so he's no event. He's not a contemporaneous event in me like the Cantos have been every single year of my life since 17, but this is not a value judgment. I don't dream of making it. I mean, people have assumed that this sort of thing is a value judgment. This has something to do with something below the roots. For instance, the roots, I know if I open Milton, the roots are the same. The event has changed. Something non-human and something that none of us are control, and that explains, I mean, doesn't explain, I mean, it's why certain poems are events. And why, for instance, certain poems at the time they're written that we now feel is tremendous events, you look all around and you don't find them happening. Where did leaves of grass happen? It's happened in almost every country of the world. It's happened it has happened in every country as a major event in every country of the world. And when you go back and look around in its own time, it doesn't seem to have happened. Or take Tudor plays.
they had to be written so fast, and there were that many plays because everybody wanted theater to go to. Now, how many of those plays happened? You know, it isn't true, the picture they usually make about Shakespeare. When they went to the play, it happened, but they were really waiting for the next play they were going to go to. And then they wanted Beaumont and Fletcher might do another big wow, and they were, it was, and then finally you remember, yes, these certain plays happened to me, or these certain movies, and the same thing happens over a long lifetime with poems. But when you're making that remark, it has to do with the event as I'm speaking right now and think of it.
What's the Whitehead?
The Whitehead is that the human being is seen not as a being but as an event, as a focus. Your eye then, by the way, changes from being here to another eye who represents the eye of the cosmos, and the only eye of the cosmos that you know at all is yourself.
Robert, if you want this to reference, the poem is a later note to letter 15, where he says, after that, and Descartes was the value, for example, and...
this is also right.
Yeah. He said the latest tape recorder automatically on the spot is a lie, as opposed to what we know went on.
Uh-huh. Well, I think...
the sense of self-action with Whitehead's important corollary to every such event is intersected by an eternal event.
And that eternal event you really don't know about.
No.
I mean, you do not know why you are able to go in a certain line. What is a blockage? What is it that when you look at a page and you want to write, you even feel you want to write, but you can't locate that want? You don't. What is it, for instance, to want to write? In the beginning, you may have reasons you think that are there, but actually you'll find that there's an urgency, and there are times when you have no... you are not... the business your conscious mind tries then is to find out, how can I possibly open up something for this wanting to come into being? And over again, I found that I couldn't do it. I mean, this is where your ingenuity, by the way, this is where the eighth really works. Meaning, H, staff, and I, all, and this may vaguely be what Freud calls the ego, all are terrifically important in finding, remember, after all, it's got to open a door here, it's got to open a door here, and the language is certainly, the major part of the language is in here, in its symbolic functions and so forth, but it doesn't really become language, tongue or language, until it's opened up this door. Tongue-tied, but you're a tongue-tied universe when you're tongue-tied, and you're like a clam shut up in the water who's got to open its... Mama, how do I open up to the tide? And then many times you're going to open up and the tide isn't there. That I watch. I watch sea anemones, they close up tight, they ain't right in that year. And because it isn't something in them, like my big subconscious says, anemone number one says, geez, my subconscious. And actually, the tide's out, that's all. And history's got times when the tide's out. No, this is one of the mysteries, but it's clear when you look at it, when you just forget yourself, you always think, I'm a tide, I'll be a tide today. You're in a tide pool. You're in a human tide pool in the first place. You're in tide pools and floods of language. The thing that we got flowing around here, we can begin to say certain things, we can't say others. I mean, I'm not talking like it's a classroom and you can't say fuck, because it's, they can only fire me for that. But I mean that there are things you actually can't say. Now, actually, to win those words was to be able to say something. And this is another part of it, isn't it? This is often puzzled. People say, you wrote that to shock. But how do you open a door? I mean, you may have to shock, that's all meaning is trying to break, and often failing, throwing away God, throwing a whole, only to come around and find them again, but throwing it away because it ceased to be open to the whole thing.
Why one can say.
So back to the business of the poem on a page, the simple business, what does the poem look like on the page, which probably, it must be at this level of meaning, because it hasn't yet made it sound. To change it, even to be wrong, but to change it, but not to change the rotten thing that can happen. Now, the people who just monkey, the monkeys. There are lots of them playing in here. Within the cage, that's fine. But that's not what we're talking about, because we are talking about the invention that takes place in here, when its purpose is. Dante talked about intent as being one of the major things in a poem. Its purpose is to restore the tree. And to restore monotree, its purpose finally is to come to the event and to find its way to the event, to, and then have it happen. I mean, the poem is an agency. It's not to have it happen in the poem. And if you didn't, if it weren't, you wouldn't need poetry. I mean, I'm talking about anyone. Obviously, poets must be rare people whose only way to the event, by the way, is through the language. We know there are many other ways to the event. And so the one thing, all of you intrigued by poetry are intrigued because, regardless of how trivial your reasons now seem, because momentarily you see a promise in the language that it would open the event that's been open for other people many, many different ways. You know, some of us feel it with having a rose garden or something. And there are always in poetry reflections of all the ways in which people come to the event. That's been part of its content.
This is very useful to me. I've become utterly impatient, for example, with such proposals as meaning in the newspaper yesterday. Because at that moment, or that moment I saw that we saw it on the steps we were coming into the house. And this meaning stirred nothing. It stirred nothing. And yet the,
stirred me.
It stirred nothing in me. I was embarrassed to say so. Because I began to try to get rid of the meaning by qualifying it, because I was not interested in that meaning at that moment at all. In other words, that meaning at that moment was meaningless. And I said, what, Robert, if it's meaningless through the agency of meaning, then
yes, yeah. As a matter of fact, see, you don't have all of meaning in your meanings either. Accessible. That can also be within here. They can be close. I know. I can give two examples from in at the time of the Korean War. I was writing for almost a year. It was on a long poem which is called An Effort at War, an essay at war, and it was a great deal of it was the excitement of Patterson, and the sense that this was that I was had to find out. To use that door fully, use it completely, and at the same time the distressing thing, and this was at language level, because we were always reading lies about Korea, and